This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
President Bush and the state of America's health care. Hello again, I'm Norman Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Britain's Economist magazine says America's health system is a monster. So the president's attention in tomorrow night's State of the Union speech will be welcome. But, as always, the devil is in the details. Health savings accounts would shift the cost of medical care from corporate employers to patients themselves, backed by tax breaks. Critics say that's great for the young, healthy, and affluent, but bad news for those who get sick. It's an aspect of the so-called ownership society, like last year's Social Security reform. Will it fare any better? On To the Point, a preview of one of this year's hottest election issues. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Norman Olney, back with To the Point. Down in the polls, President Bush will emphasize health care reform in tomorrow night's State of the Union address. On To the Point, we'll hear about health savings accounts. Are they the right medicine for employers and workers alike? Or good for the healthy and bad for the sick? Will tomorrow's proposals fare better than Social Security reform? First, this news update in Houston today. Jury selection began in the trial of Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling, the former top Enron executives accused of fraud, insider trading, and lying about Enron's corporate strength. It's the biggest trial in one of America's biggest financial scandals. Rebecca Smith is national energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal, co-author of 24 Days, How Two Wall Street Journal Reporters Uncovered the Lies That Destroyed Faith in Corporate America. Rebecca Smith, as always, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
The judge today in Houston told the jurors that they were not to try to seek vengeance against either Ken Lay or Jeffrey Skilling or Enron. Remind us of what it is that people in Houston might want to seek vengeance for.
Well, there's probably no company in Houston that better epitomized the new economy and the wave of the future for energy companies than Enron. So there was a lot of civic pride in the company's, you know, stellar rise in stock price and value and so on throughout the 1980s and 90s, particularly the late 1990s. And when the company collapsed in late 2001, there was a feeling of great betrayal in Houston. And also Ken Lay had been a very prominent civic leader, had spearheaded a lot of fundraising efforts, such as building a baseball stadium and lots of things of that sort. So I think the community felt aggrieved. It lost thousands of jobs, and it felt very angry at having been besmirched.
So then, in addition to the stockholders around the country who had a portion of the losses that they had to share, the people in Houston really were more directly involved in this than is often the case in a big financial scandal.
I think that's true. And, of course, the fact that you had, more than 4,000 jobs that were lost also meant that there were a lot of people who, as you may recall, lost their retirement savings because they were heavily invested in Enron stock through their 401k plans. So you suddenly had a lot of very sympathetic people out in the community talking about how they'd also been basically tricked by the company that employed them.
Rebecca Smith, again, with The Wall Street Journal. Your co-author in 24 Days has written in the paper about the star witness, Andrew Fastow, who may provide some problems for both sides. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, Andy is one of the key figures in this case, and he is coming down. He's playing for the prosecution, as it were, since he has a guilty plea. His wife has already done some jail time. But basically, what Enron was doing was hiding losses by creating some off-balance sheet vehicles. And these vehicles were managed, and in some cases, the major investor was Andy Fastow, who was the company's chief financial officer. So it began with a clear conflict of interest. He was wearing hats where he was representing himself. He made millions of dollars off these deals, and he was supposed to be representing shareholders in the company, and he had a fiduciary duty to them. So we have this image of a sort of a turncoat witness now who will be a star witness for the prosecution against his former bosses.
We're talking about the Enron prosecution with Rebecca Smith of the Wall Street Journal. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, Fastow has now pled guilty to crimes. He is, again, supposed to be the star witness. And it's interesting that he's a man who Kenneth Lay once described as acting in the best interest of shareholders, operating in the most ethical and appropriate manner possible. And it was the very next day that Fastow made remarks to some of the board members that caused him to lose his job and the whole thing to come tumbling down.
Well, I think what we'll see is we'll probably see claims in this case that Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay did not know how much money Andy Fastow was making on the side. It was almost as if he was running his own hedge fund that was investing in Enron assets. I think they'll probably say they didn't understand that he was making millions and millions of dollars, far more from these deals than he was from his salary at the company. But we'll see. All of this will be one of the interesting things to see unfold in the coming weeks.
Obviously, after to attack the star witness in order to defend yourself, are Skilling and Lay using pretty much the same defense, or are they in any way blaming one another?
Well, no, they have to hold together. They're a team. They're being tried together. The one thing we haven't talked about, though, Warren, is the fact that until a month ago, we had three defendants in this case, and the third one is the former chief accounting officer, Rick Causey. So for basically the 4 years or so it's taken this case to come to trial, well, actually not quite that long, but in the time since they've been charged, there were three defendants, and then Rick Causey, as of about a month ago, around Christmas time, he also decided to plead guilty, and he now will, as well as Andy Fastow, be a witness for the prosecution. So this completely changes the entire dynamics, and I would think has sent a rocket through the defense team.
So again, then, a lot at stake, of course, for these people. How long is this trial expected to go on?
Well, probably a minimum of 4 months, but these things have a way of dragging out longer, so I'd say 4 to 6 is probably more realistic.
4 to 6, and we're going to find out a lot about what was really going on in the Enron Corporation.
Right.
Rebecca Smith, as always, good to have you with us.
Thanks a lot, Warren.
Again, author of co-author, 24 Days, How Two Wall Street Journal Reporters Uncovered the Lies That Destroyed Corporate Faith, destroyed faith, rather, in corporate America. In a moment, President Bush and the state of America's health system. On Reporter's Notebook later, Hamas and the consequences of spreading democracy in the Middle East. On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren, I'll be back with To the Point. Since President and Hillary Clinton's ill-fated proposals of 1993, the cost of health care has doubled. More people than ever have no health insurance at all. In tomorrow's State of the Union address, President Bush is expected to propose a plan derived from his ideas about an ownership society. Dr. Jeremy Lazarus is a psychiatrist in Denver, Colorado, and an officer on the Board of Trustees of the American Medical Association. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
One of the highlights, as we understand it, of the proposals being drafted by the White House are health savings accounts. Can you tell us what health savings accounts are exactly and how it is that they are expected to help deal with some of the problems of the health system?
Well, fundamentally, a health savings account allows individuals and families to put aside a tax-deductible proportion of money in an account that then can pay for qualified medical expenses either in the current year or to be saved for use in future years. And then that's coupled with a high deductible plan, usually, that provides health insurance. Those are the basics of the health savings accounts.
Okay. And who are they, or how are they supposed to deal with what you regard as the major problems of the health system?
Well, it is one way that individuals and families can purchase insurance and have more choice in terms of the kind of benefit that they could get. As we see it, though, this doesn't deal effectively with the large problem of the 46 million uninsured. It does provide one avenue for individuals and families, however, to provide health care benefits for themselves.
Why doesn't it deal with the uninsured?
Well, we've got 46 million uninsured. This is really a tragedy for the American public. We have 18,000 Americans dying each year because they don't have insurance. And the vast majority of those individuals are low-income individuals who are employed and either are unable to pay for the premiums that are provided through the health insurance of their employers, or the employers are actually not providing that insurance. And the vast majority of those individuals would probably not have access to or be able to afford the HSAs.
So in other words, they wouldn't have the money to put aside to get the tax-deductible accounts built up, and they wouldn't be able to afford the premiums even on a high-deductible insurance policy.
That's correct.
Okay. What then about some of the other parts of the program? It's my understanding that they're looking to limit awards in medical malpractice lawsuits and also provide some changes with regard to the nationalization of the issue, try to get around the fact that many of the states have imposed various regulatory practices. How much of an issue is that, as far as you're concerned, and do you think that might deal with the issues you raised?
Well, the AMA, of course, is very supportive of placing caps on malpractice liability awards and have been pushing for that for years and years, so we are very supportive of that. The issue of reducing some of the regulation across state lines also has some merit, and we would be supportive of that in terms of actually increasing the ability of markets to work better, as long as patient protections are kept in mind.
Back to patient protections. The way this is often described is the theory of the health savings accounts as opposed to what we have now is that if people, in fact, have to be responsible for a larger portion of their medical expenses, then they are likely to be more careful about it and less likely to demand of doctors that they get treatments of one kind or another or drugs that they've seen advertised on TV or whatever some of the other reasons are that they've been demanding more supposedly than they need. Is that a good argument?
Well, we think there is a merit to that argument. However, it doesn't take into account the fact that the largest portions of health care in the United States are borne by those that have chronic illnesses. So the health savings accounts actually wouldn't take care of that part of it. People would not be able to have discretion in terms of, you know, taking care of their long-term diabetes or asthma or depression or other serious and chronic medical conditions.
So in other words, then, you are at the American Medical Association somewhat in support of the president's program, but you don't think it goes far enough?
We're in support of HSAs as part of a pluralistic system, but think that we have a better plan to deal with the uninsured.
And what would your plan do?
Our plan basically is based on three pillars, and that would be individual choice so that individuals and families can choose the kind of health plan that they think most benefits them, tax credits that would allow for individuals to purchase insurance, tax credits that would be inversely proportional to income, and then freeing up markets to work more effectively.
Well, those are, though, some things that are dealt with, you indicated before, by the president's plan, the free markets with regard to the state restrictions, the tax credits is certainly a part of the president's plan, and the element of choices as well, isn't it?
Well, I haven't heard what the president has to say yet, but I haven't heard tax credits, I think, are something that the president has been interested in. We are interested in a very large program to allow tax credits for low-income individuals and inversely proportional to income.
Okay, and of course, tax credits, and perhaps I overlooked this, are different from tax deductibility.
That's correct.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that you would actually give low-income workers, especially those in the lower-income brackets, tax credits to purchase insurance as opposed to being able to deduct health premiums from your taxes.
All right. Dr. Jeremy Lazarus, again, psychiatrist in Denver and officer on the AMA's Board of Trustees. Diane Rowland is executive director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. She's vice president of the Henry Kaiser Family Foundation. That's a nonprofit that focuses on major health care issues. And Diane Rowland, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be back. Thank you.
What are your concerns about the president's plan?
Well, we know that one of the biggest personal worries that Americans have right now is the affordability of health care. So putting the issue of health care costs on the agenda in Washington is something that I think will really resonate with the public. But I think the public's concern with costs is going to lead them to be quite wary of proposals where they think they're going to end up paying more, not less, for their health care.
Why would they pay more, not less?
Well, I think when you talk about high deductible plans and health savings accounts, you're really talking about less comprehensive health insurance, which may well encourage people to skip or delay some routine care. You're talking about a situation in which people will have very limited information on price, limited ability to pick new doctors, and much less ability to choose among specialists and hospitals. So I think they're going to be concerned that more cost is being shifted onto them, that their out-of-pocket costs are going up, but they're not getting better health care benefits for it.
One of the points we understand the president will talk about, and again, of course, we don't fully know until he makes the speech, is transparency in pricing. Why is that so important?
Well, if you're going to make choices about whether to have a procedure or not, or whether to see a particular doctor or not, you need to know what the difference is in price between different procedures and different physicians. However, I don't really think that most people, when they're sick, make their decision based on the cost. They make it based on the ability to get well. So I'm not sure that we're going to really see second-guessing your doctor as the best way the American public thinks they're going to reduce health care spending.
If you want to increase choice, though, how do you base that on the ability to get well? How is an individual patient supposed to determine whether one procedure, one medicine, one specialist or another will be the right one?
Well, that's where I think people in serious medical need are not likely to be frugal or informed shoppers, because they're going to go through, during this time of personal distress, reliance on the medical professionals that tell them what tests they need and what options they have for getting better. And I think that's where the difficulty is with trying to think that based on price, American consumers are going to make very hard health care choices when they're ill and in need of care.
Is there overuse of the system now? And if so, is it due more to the patients or more to the doctors?
Well, we know in some cases services are utilized overtly. We know that there may be ways that technology has been introduced that is being too often used by too many people, sometimes at the recommendation of their doctor, sometimes because they've seen ads on television and want to really pursue a particular strategy. But we also know that cost matters, and that the uninsured get less care, they delay care, and just as Dr. Lazarus noted, 18,000 people a year die prematurely because they're without health insurance coverage. So cost makes a big barrier to people getting the kind of care they need.
One of the things that I've seen attributed to your organization, the Kaiser Family Foundation, is the concern that the health savings accounts are good for the young and the wealthy and the healthy, but that they aren't so good for people who are chronically ill, another issue mentioned by Dr. Lazarus, or the poor and the elderly. Is that an accurate summary of your feelings at the moment?
Well, certainly in the analyses that we've done, new tax breaks tend to be expensive and regressive, offering the largest benefits to those with the highest income because of the way in which our tax system is structured. What one looks at when you look at the uninsured population is that they're by and large families that are very low income or modest income, two-thirds of them from families with an income of less than $40,000 for family of four. So for those families, as Dr. Lazarus pointed out, having the ability to set aside money in a health savings account and only really having a catastrophic health insurance policy may not be the most prudent way for them to match their family's health needs with the realities of their family budget.
All right. Some concerns about what we believe will be the proposals tomorrow in the State of the Union message by President Bush. Diana Rowland, let me ask you this. What about the litany that we hear again and again from legislators and others, particularly on the Democratic side, that every other developed nation in the world has a universal health care plan that's pretty much handled by the government, and that they are more satisfied with their health care than Americans are, and they're spending less on it. Is that an option?
Well, certainly we know that the multiple choices that we have and the multiple payers we have in our healthcare system contributes to a lack of a coherent strategy for how to address some of the big societal issues about how much do we as a nation want to spend on healthcare, what kinds of new developments and new technologies are really worth pursuing. And so those who look at the experience of other countries say that there are prudent ways to pursue that. Critics, of course, would point out that in some of those countries, there's longer waiting times and more delay to get procedures. But I think one has to think about a societal way of addressing health care costs, not having individuals one by one try and bring down the costs of our health care.
Again, we're talking about health care and the president's stress in the State of the Union message tomorrow, which we are anticipating. This is To the Point from PRI. I'm going to go back to Dr. Lazarus at the American Medical Association. There was a time in the history of your organization that national health care was regarded, or universal health care, as a socialized medicine. That was a phrase that was used a lot some decades ago. Is that still the case? Are you worried that if the government, in fact, takes over, that patients, doctors alike, will lose control over medical care?
Well, the AMA is opposed to a national single-payer system, but basically we think we have a better proposal, as I talked to you about before. And we think that the AMA proposal basically enhances choice that patients can make. It encourages patients to be conscious of health insurance costs, and it maintains the private sector innovation that that we're so proud of. Our concerns about single-payer systems that they don't have those advantages, that they have problems, as Ms. Rowland talked about, like undersupply of medical personnel, long waiting lines, and lack of patient choice. So we think we have a better proposal that's basically building on the current system that we have now.
American Medical Association is going to be very involved in the debate about this, of course, in the Congress. What do you think, Dr. Lazarus, are the prospects now for a greater reliance on health savings accounts that the president is talking about, or the additional or perhaps alternative proposals you're making?
Well, we hope that in the current debate and the next year or two that this will rise to the top of the health of the agenda for the Congress and for the president, and that we will find ways to get these 46 million uninsured in the tent of being insured and provide access and coverage for them.
Diana Rowland, back to you at the Kaiser Family Foundation. What if it doesn't become a national priority? What if we don't make some changes?
Well, if we don't make some changes, we're going to continue to see health care costs rise, taking a bigger and bigger burden on states through the Medicaid program, which they help finance, through Medicare, which we all help finance, and through employer-based coverage. And we're going to see growing numbers of uninsured. I think increasingly the problem with rising health care costs is that the premiums for health insurance are getting more and more unaffordable for not only families but also for the businesses they work in. And we're seeing an erosion of coverage at a time when health care costs are taking a bigger and bigger chunk out of family budgets.
Dr. Lazarus, back to you. With GM and Ford in such trouble, talking about legacy costs as they refer to them, including health care costs, a major factor in their problems, is it a good idea to move away from an employer-financed health care system?
Well, the AMA believes that people should be able to choose whether they want to go with an employer-based system or choose an individual plan on their own, and we think that we can build on the employer-based system as it is now. So we think that by providing these tax credits, as I mentioned, that are inversely proportional to income, that people would have more choice. But we don't see the unraveling of the employer-based system at the present time.
We're going to continue this conversation in a moment. Meantime, thanks to Dr. Jeremy Lazarus of the AMA and Diana Rowland of the Henry Kaiser Family Foundation. On Reporter's Notebook later is the electoral victory of Hamas, an unintended consequence of American policy in the Middle East. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, we're only back with To the Point to try to define the terms with regard to health care reform as it's likely to be proposed by the president tomorrow in his State of the Union address. We've talked about health savings accounts, about the tax deductible, high deductible insurance policies, about transparency in pricing, and about limits on awards in medical malpractice lawsuits. Matt Baez, contributing writer to the New York Times magazines, covers national politics as well, wrote in yesterday's magazine that the president has been handed a rare opportunity with regard to health care, but that his proposals lack ambition. Matt Baez, welcome to you.
Hey, Warren, thank you.
Why do they lack ambition? What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that, you know, what's lost in all this discussion sometimes is that we're really at a very unprecedented moment in this debate. You know, when the Clintons proposed their health care plan in the early 1990s, which we all know about now, at that time there was some recognition, a growing recognition, that there was a serious crisis among people who were uninsured in this country, that costs were high. But at that time, you know, it was somewhat of a concern for business. And, of course, that plan failed to be enacted. In the 10 years since, we've seen an explosion. Healthcare costs have doubled. The number of uninsured have risen. Business, which used to consider this one of many problems, now in many cases, if not most, considers it the single greatest impediment to American competitiveness. And I think there is a much greater consensus for this president than there was for the last one, plus the fact that he is unabashedly a pro-business president who would have a much greater capacity to be trusted and to entice the business community into a discussion than his predecessors. And you put all of that together, and what you have, he also has a Republican Congress, which the last president did not have a Congress of his own party. So when you put all of that together, what you have is this incredible opportunity to do something transformative, to really bring the country forward into what I think will have to be the next era of healthcare, and it will be very different from the one that came before. This president has not shown an interest in doing that, and to me that's a lost opportunity.
What do you mean he hasn't shown an interest in doing it? What about the proposals that we've heard? Why don't they cope with the issues that you're referring to?
Well, those are all fine proposals if you buy the ideological basis. I don't dispute that some of those proposals can be effective. Healthcare savings accounts, for instance, which is the centerpiece, can help some people afford health care and could have some cost control impact, although I think it's important to remember that for a person to benefit from health care savings accounts, they have to be able to afford health care and afford to save money on top of it in the first place. So that's a fairly self-selecting crowd. But these are not programs that affect the structural basis. They are consistent with the ideological mission of this administration across the board in trying to remove responsibility and risk from government and get people more involved. And I, for one, happen to think that the idea of people having more ownership and more options is not only a good one, but it is the inevitable way of society and the direction that we're going. But these are not programs that change the actual structure of healthcare. I just heard the tail end of the conversation you were having, and the gentleman from the AMA saying, well, the employer-based system's not really unraveling now. Well, I don't really know how anyone can say that. If by now we mean this year or next year, that's probably true. But if we're going to do any kind of long-term thinking, which we are so loath to do here in Washington, I think we have to come to the conclusion and face the reality that the system of employee-based health care of the last century is not going to be the system of the next century. And there are structural problems that we have, the uninsured, the costs, the increasing burden on business, that all of these things are going to have to be addressed in a much bolder way than putting out than tinkering at the margins of this problem.
Matt Bai again now with the New York Times Magazine. Ramesh Panuru is a senior editor at the National Review Magazine, and welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
I suspect philosophically you probably agree with a lot that Matt Bai has said, and certainly with the president and the idea of shifting responsibility and putting it more on individuals. What about his complaint that this doesn't go far enough, that it's not bold enough? Do you agree with that? And if so, why do you think it doesn't?
Well, you know, listening to Matt and reading his article, it struck me that there are, you know, when people say things are conservative, they can mean a couple different things. But two of the things they can mean is, one, you could have a sort of comprehensive health care reform plan based on conservative lines. And what Matt's arguing for, I think he's not so much concerned about whether it's a liberal or conservative plan, is that you have to have something comprehensive that addresses all of the systemic problems in healthcare and tries to solve them. But the alternative to a comprehensive plan is something that's conservative in the sense of Burkean, that is, sort of makes small changes to the existing system and doesn't try to make the big, bold, let's start over, let's draw from scratch sort of more perfect healthcare policies. And I think that there is some appeal to both kinds of approaches, but in general, the prudent thing to do and the wise thing to do is probably to go the incremental route, because it's not just a question of whether you can get all of the provider groups and American business and unions and all the other many interests that have an interest in healthcare to agree. You also have to keep in mind that the majority of American people, while they have grave and legitimate doubts about health care, the health care system, are reasonably satisfied with their own health care. And anything that's called a comprehensive reform, even if it could get all the interest groups on board, which is obviously a very tall order, is going to scare a lot of people, people who are going to think, you know, a comprehensive reform could be a reform that threatens what they value about their health care. And in that context, and with narrow Republican majorities that are less and less inclined to obey orders from this White House, a small-scale incremental approach may make the most sense.
What about the failure, or apparent failure, of the proposal to change Social Security? That, by comparison, it seems to me, was a lot bolder. A lot of people called it radical. Do you think, Ramesh Ponuru, that that might be the reason that the president's pulling back a bit?
Well, I think that if Social Security reform had succeeded, a more substantial and bold ownership agenda on health care would have made sense. I mean, if Social Security reform had succeeded and the president had been able to reduce the future promised benefits of Social Security, I think it would have made a lot of things more achievable, including Medicare reform. But it didn't happen. I think this president is skeptical of the idea that almost anything he proposes domestically will be able to get substantial Democratic support, and that anything he's going to have to do is going to have to be narrow and cautious and just eke out a majority.
Ramesh Ponuru with the National Review. Back to Matt Bai with the New York Times. Are you then making the perfect the enemy of the good?
No, I don't think so, and I don't disagree with Ramesh in principle that incrementalism is often the way that real change occurs. I really don't. But I think when we talk about incrementalism, we have to remember that increments, by definition, are leading us somewhere. These incremental steps aren't leading us somewhere except to give people who already have money or who already have access to health care some more options and some more available means to pay their deductibles or more options for what kind of health care. They're not leading us toward the new really paradigm for healthcare that we're going to need as a country. I mean, look, the reality is businesses are laboring to compete in a global marketplace. The number one cost area for them is healthcare and benefits. They have, you know, this system grew up out of a response from business to try and lure employees in a exponentially growing economy. That's not the case anymore. Once some big companies, your GM and your Ford and others, begin to scale back on what they can afford to do in terms of benefits, other companies that aren't necessarily under the same global competitive pressures are going to do that too, because why should they continue to offer these kinds of health care plans when larger companies don't? I think we have to look at the future, and I'm not suggesting, as Ramesh I think thinks I am, that, you know, this requires a bold national solution that we can get every interest group to sign off on tomorrow. I don't know how to do that. What I'm saying is, and what I say in the story is, that there are plans out there that are pilot plans that could be tested. This president could look at what former Governor Kitzhaber has suggested in Oregon, which is to have the state opt out of Medicare and Medicaid, to take a block grant, something this administration is ideologically at least very fond of, the notion of block grants instead of specific government programs, and use that block grant for a state-based system that would offer access to health care to every citizen. That's the kind of plan that could be tested. It's a pilot program. The same with the individual mandate plan, I won't get into the details of, but that Mitt Romney in Massachusetts has proposed. There are solutions out there that need that could have backing, that could have government support. We could see if they work. This president, you know, should theoretically have the political capital to get that done. I'm really surprised to hear Ramesh say this president has to worry about Democrats. He can only eke out. We've been told for years, ever since this administration came into office, that they're going to do what they want to do, that they're going to persuade people and bring them to their point of view, that they don't have to compromise, that they think boldly. If that's representative of all of what the Republican approach is going to be for the rest of this administration, it's a marked departure from what we've been hearing all along.
Ramesh Ponuru, what about that? Have those days, are they long gone?
Well, look, I think a lot of that was a combination of Republican spin and Democratic sort of hysteria about the extent of the changes that the president has advocated and brought about over the last few years. Of course, there's always been compromise. The president's always been constrained by political considerations, and I think this year those constraints are more substantial than usual. But look, this healthcare system we have now has grown up incrementally over the last 70 years. You know, I mean, the whole idea that we're going to have an employer-based healthcare system in many respects is an unintended consequence of World War II era wage controls, which businesses had to try to evade by offering health care benefits. And then after the war, you had favorable tax treatment of those benefits, sort of legitimizing what had gone on beforehand. So we evolved the system, and it has, as it turns out, it has become less and less tenable in a modern economy characterized by the fluidity and flexibility that we all recognize has been increasing all around us. Now, I guess part of my disagreement here is I don't believe that the proposals the president's putting forward are, shall we say, a bridge to nowhere. I think that it makes a great deal of sense to say, look, the system we've evolved isn't really true insurance. What it is prepayment of routine medical expenses for people who have jobs that offer that program. And if you don't have a job that offers those sorts of benefits, you're effectively sort of locked out of the system. What the president wants to do, I gather, is to move towards more of a true insurance model where you're insuring against unpredictable but substantial risks, and you're having more out-of-pocket payment for routine medical expenses. Now, the theory here is not just that a lot of people will be able to afford it, and in fact, a third to half of the people who've signed up for the new health savings accounts over the last 2 years have been new people who haven't had health coverage before. So it's not true that it won't benefit non-insured people. It will. But also, if you create this new market and enough people get involved, you will begin to have a real marketplace develop in healthcare with the possibility that you'll have increased efficiencies and reduced costs.
All right. Obviously, we're getting a preview of some of the debate we're going to hear this year, no doubt, after the President's State of the Union address. There are many, many elections upcoming. All the Congress and a big part of the Senate as well, of course, are up for election. Matt Bai, back to you for one more question. In California and other places as well, I think, Democrats are offering single-payer, universal-style health care plans. Is there, at the moment, do you think, any chance that some state might go that route? Certainly the federal government is not going in that direction.
Well, I honestly can't tell you whether that could be an eventuality in a state or not, but I agree with the second part of your statement. There's no way. As a practical matter, that is not right now a viable solution.
Well, if, in fact, some state did decide they wanted to do that, would you then, based on what you said earlier about Oregon and the block grant program that it's interested in, think that that's something that ought to be allowed?
Well, I think I think it makes sense to let states experiment how they want to. Yeah, and that's a very Republican and conservative ideal, so no one should argue with that. If a state thinks they've got a plan that'll work, I don't think we're in any position nationally to tell them it can't, because we really don't have a system. We keep talking about fixing a system. The truth is there isn't much of a system at this point. I don't think any kind of blanket national solution, single payer or otherwise, is viable unless and until government and business can sit down and work on this together. There is a natural overlap of interests here. There should be a constituency out there among business leaders who can sit with government and say, okay, we've gotten tax breaks for health care for years. Maybe we're willing to give them up. What can government do about health care?
Okay, back to Ramesh Panur, and I'm sorry to interrupt Matt Bai, but we're running short of time. Is that kind of debate going on? And right back to this issue of the states, it's my understanding part of the Bush program is to prevent certain state mandates, to give insurance companies the opportunity to go national. Why that? Is that really a conservative idea in a states' rights platform?
Sure, no. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on this point. This administration has been interested in giving waivers to states that want to try different ideas on Medicaid. But I think what you have in mind here is for individual insurance purchasers, a lot of states have mandates that raise the cost of that insurance that say, look, if you're going to buy insurance in this state, you've got to get coverage for chiropractic. You've got to get coverage for hair transplants. You've got to get coverage for alcoholism treatment, all of which may be perfectly good ideas individually, but raise the cost of insurance and make it hard to get a bare-bones, cheap insurance policy. The administration's idea, actually a bill of John Shattuck's in the U.S. House, is to say we're going to allow states to continue to have mandates that govern insurance policies bought in that state, but people are going to be allowed to cross state lines. You know, if Delaware doesn't have as substantial mandates, you can buy your health insurance from a provider in Delaware, and so you're going to have a competitive marketplace.
Okay, we're going to have to end it at that. Thanks to both of you for being with us, Matt Bai and Ramesh Punuru. This is To the Point from PRI. Mahmoud Abbas says he will not step down as president of the Palestinian Authority, despite his Fatah party's stunning defeat by Hamas in last week's election. Meantime, the U.S. wants other countries to join it in cutting off aid to a new government unless Hamas changes its ways. In a moment, the unintended consequences of the Bush administration's policy of spreading democracy in the Middle East. More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Foreman Alney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. As Secretary Rice spread the message to European allies in London, President Bush said again today the U.S. will not deal with a Palestinian party that includes an armed wing and whose charter calls for eliminating another country, that of course being Israel. He said this about Hamas and democracy.
This new democracy that's emerging in the Palestinian territories must understand that you can't have a political party that also has got a armed wing to it. That democracies yield peace. And so the second half of our message to Hamas is get rid of your arms. Disavow terrorism. Work to bring what you promised to the people of the Palestinian territories.
President Bush is speaking today at the White House. Cliff May is president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, group started after September 11th. He's a former communications director for the Republican National Committee. And Cliff May, thanks for coming back on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Secretary Rice said today that what happened is in part a function of the fact that the United States didn't see it coming, that its intelligence simply wasn't good enough. As she says, we didn't have a good enough pulse. Others are saying that the administration was so wedded to its belief in democracy that it simply ignored the dangers of people coming to power by a vote of this kind that were not people that were acceptable to the United States. What do you say?
Well, I think both can be true. They're not mutually exclusive. There have been other elections in the Palestinian territories. They have been flawed elections, although better than what you find in a lot of the region. Yasser Arafat, in 35 years in power, ran exactly once against an older woman whose name I doubt any of us can recall. The last time you had parliamentary elections was 10 years ago. At some point after Arafat's death, you had to have parliamentary elections again. That said, democracy is more than just holding elections. It also requires a civil society, which is not very well developed in the Palestinian territories, where you've had mosques and media and schools preaching hatred of Israel, anti-Semitism, for at least 10 years, at least since Arafat was brought back from exile in Tunis to the territories and installed as what was supposed to be a friendly dictator.
Let me interrupt then. If that's the case, then, has the stress on elections by the Bush administration been misplaced?
I'm not sure that the Bush administration could have said, I know, let's not have elections for the parliament in Gaza and the West Bank for another 10 years because civil society is not sufficient yet there. I think it sort of had to be done, but there were imperfect elections. But now I think the point is to live with this
reality. Well, wait a minute, everyone's saying they aren't. It wasn't an imperfect election in the sense that it was fairly held and that the options were, in fact, a very high turnout. Options reflected what the people wanted.
Yes, but when I say it wasn't entirely free and fair, it was free and fair in the sense we don't know that ballots were manipulated or anything like that. But imagine if there had been a peace party. Imagine if there had been Palestinian dissidents who got up and said, look, you vote for us, and this struggle is over. We'll have our own state, we'll negotiate the borders, and your children will live in peace and prosperity. No one can doubt that such a candidate standing on a soapbox in Ramallah would have been killed within minutes.
Okay. Cliff May, again, the president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Graham Fuller is former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, held that job in the 80s. He's author of several books, and the latest is The Future of Political Islam. Graham Fuller, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What about the issue that is being raised with regard to the president's support for democracy? He said again today in his speech that democracies are, not in his speech, but in his comments to reporters, that and we heard it a moment ago, that democracies are, in fact, peaceful, that therefore Hamas has got to change its ways. Where do you come down on the president's policy with regard to democracy?
Well, in the end, I think it's imperative that democracy come to the region. I would say that most of the problems of rage, frustration, bad governance, sense of impotence, all stem from a lack of voice that people have over their own destiny and their own futures. They have no voice over anything. So in principle, therefore, I think it's absolutely essential that the region move towards democracy. Now, this doesn't mean it's going to be a panacea, that it's going to solve all problems instantly. It doesn't mean that that the people that we want to be elected will necessarily be elected. But I think that could be said in lots of countries, and many Europeans would say that even about the United States, that the system brought somebody that they didn't like. Or we could say it about the Israeli government or any number. So, in effect, once you buy into the system, you're sort of stuck with it. You have to go with it. But there are problems, unquestionably.
Well, if that's the case, then what about the position now that's being taken by the United States and by other countries as well, that as long as Hamas, despite its victory in the elections, won't repudiate its charter calling for the destruction of Israel or vow to stop violence or, in fact, disarm, we won't deal with it. Does that make sense?
I think that is probably a slightly extreme position that the administration has taken on this, extreme in the sense that I don't think it's going to work. In the Palestinian thinking, basically, they feel they are being asked to give up all their cards, namely their ability to carry out an armed struggle and offer recognition to Israel, to give that all up for a nominal peace process that over the past 20 or more years has not delivered and has not brought them the state they wanted, and all the while the Israelis creating new facts on the ground which make it worse and worse from their point of view. So I think from Hamas' position, this is a bargaining tool that if, in fact, the political process of negotiation does begin to work, then I think there would be incredible pressure ultimately on Hamas to back away from that. But I just don't think they're going to give up all their cards at the beginning any more than Israel is willing to give up all its cards by pulling out. I mean, Palestinians say, you pull out completely from the West Bank, then we'll have confidence in your goodwill and good faith and we can go ahead and negotiate. But if you're going to have preconditions for one side, I think you have to have preconditions for the other.
Graham Fuller, again, formerly with the CIA, now author of The Future of Political Islam. Back to Cliff May with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. What do you say to that? Why is it that Hamas is being required to change its position when nobody else is?
Hamas has dedicated itself to the elimination of Israel entirely. That cannot be a starting point, and they have vowed to use terrorism to do it. Now, they may not do so, but they're not talking, as Graham seems to suggest, about the Israelis simply pulling back to the 67 borders. That's not what they're talking about in their charter. We're just closing our eyes to what they're saying. They are for the elimination of Israel.
Today, as I understand it, what they said was they want to see Israel be willing to pull back to the 67 borders, and then we'll talk about these other issues. But in the meantime, we'll have a long-term ceasefire. Is that a beginning? Should it be regarded as a beginning?
No, a beginning is a beginning may be a truce where if Hamas does not attack Israel, Israel does not attack Hamas. That is the beginning. The idea that Israel should pull back to the 67 borders in exchange for a promise that there will be no terrorist attacks until the next terrorist attack doesn't make any sense at all. The Israelis won't do it, and it's not realistic to think they will or ask them to do that. They have said very clearly as well, if you read the fine print, it's not that fine, pulling Israel back to the 67 borders is a stage in a process that is meant to result in the elimination of Israel entirely, because all of Palestine, all of the Middle East, is in their religious conviction, let's respect their convictions, in their religious conviction, a wafk.
Okay, Graham Fuller, back to you on that point. Is that where we are?
I think it's absolutely correct to state that there has been extreme rhetoric on the part of Hamas in the past, and it is written in their charter of some almost 20 years ago. The question is, in a real world, is this really where Hamas is going? In a real world, many Israeli extremists have said that they should keep all the West Bank and indeed even parts of Jordan, and there's been talk of the old saw about from the Nile to the Euphrates in the eyes of some zealots. I think in reality, when governments come to power, they've got to deliver to the people. The Palestinian people, I don't think, really believe that in the end Israel is going to go away completely. They do believe, however, that they should be able to get back their territory that was lost in the 1967 war. And I suspect that if that comes about and reasonable governance comes about, whether it's under Hamas or anybody else, then that this pipe dream of reversing history entirely will fade away as people turn to their own lives. But that's not what you have now. You've got the humiliation and terrible complexities of daily inspections and checkpoints and more land being taken and more facts on the ground and more Israeli control of water and transportation and entry in and out of the country. Under these conditions, I don't think it's surprising at all, and I don't think the administration should have been surprised that there would be overwhelming support for Hamas at this point.
Thank you both. The beat goes on. Graham Fuller, formerly with the CIA, the book The Future of Political Islam, Cliff May, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I appreciate both of you being with us today. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Jonah King and Francis Anderton, Technical Director Mike New. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.